Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. For this special bonus episode, I am joined by author Eric Brock, who wrote the book Double Lives, True Tales of the Criminals Next Door, set to release on August 15th, 2018. Eric and I decided to team up to bring you a story featured in his book. The later dubbed Cadet Murders would send the town of Mansfield, Texas, reeling after the death of a star student. Everyone was now asking, who killed Adrian Jones? Okay, on to the show.
The story begins in Mansfield, Texas, which is a small town just southeast of Fort Worth, which itself is a smaller city to the larger metro area of Dallas in north central part of the state. Mansfield is a quiet little town, or at least it was until late 1995, when something horrible happened that would change it forever. Before that, though, everything was quiet and hunky-dory and really good, especially for two people named David Graham and Diane DeMora.
Before we go into the history of David and Diane, I want to talk about Adrian Jones first. After all, she's the most important part of this story. Adrian Jessica Jones, whose nickname was AJ, was born on May 12, 1979, in Mansfield, Texas, to Linda Sue and Bill Jones. The eldest of three, her younger brothers Justin and Scott, admired and loved their sister. She was the type of person who could put her friends in a good mood. She was the person everyone went to just to feel better. Adrian loved animals and sports. She doted on her three dogs, which inspired her to want to become a veterinarian. She was very athletic and competed in soccer and cross country, hobbies she continued when she entered high school. She was a popular student who amassed a large friend group and admirers. An honor student with a glowing personality made Adrian a target of jealousy and lust. She spent hours getting ready for social events, and her friends often called her a big flirt. Adrian could entrap you with her gaze and invite you in with her warm smile. She was the very definition of popular. Although carefree and bubbly, she had strict rules to adhere to at home. Like most high school students, she had a curfew and could only use the phone until 10 p.m. To circumvent the curfew rule, Adrian and her girlfriends would hang out in her front lawn, waiting for friends to drive by. That socialization would consume hours of her time, which she welcomed. From Bill and Linda Sue's perspective, this was fine. It's not as if they thought their daughter was a troublemaker or promiscuous. They just wanted to protect her from outside influences, especially if those influences were bad. She was employed at the Golden Fried Chicken restaurant and built a great rapport with her regulars. Adrian had come to know many students through sports. That is where she met acquaintance David Christopher Graham. David was born on November 2, 1977, in Tarrant County, Texas. His parents, Jerry, a school principal, and Janice, a teacher, had divorced when David was young, leaving David to choose to live with his father after the divorce. The youngest of four, David had great aspirations for himself and dreamed of becoming a pilot.
He was always interested in serving his community, and to that end, he joined the Civil Air Patrol, which is kind of like the Air Force for kids who are interested in someday becoming part of the military. He even managed to earn his pilot's license at age 14 before he even got his license to fly. Very dedicated, very focused, very interested in serving, protecting, and doing what was right. And then there's Diane Zamora, who wasn't all that different.
Diane Michelle Zamora was born to Theodore and Gloria Zamora on January 21st, 1978. The Zamora family lived a modest life in Crowley, Texas. The eldest of four in a devoutly Catholic Hispanic family, Diane was responsible for being a role model to her younger siblings. In his book, Double Lives, True Tales of the Criminals Next Door, Eric points out that Diane was incredibly devoted to her education. When the family could not afford to pay their electricity bill, Diane often did her homework by candlelight. To say that Diane was a busy teenager is an understatement. She played the flute in the marching band and ran cross country. On the weekends she wasn't busy with school activities, she worked at Fast Forward, a teenage clothing store. Like David and Adrian, she too was an honor student but attended high school 40 minutes away in Crowley. She dreamed of becoming an astronaut, which is why she joined the Civil Air Patrol post, and how she first knew David Graham. Her family knew nothing could stand in the way of what Diane wanted, especially when she made up her mind. She dreamed of a life away from Crowley, away from the things that reminded her of her lot in life. That is, until she met David Graham, the summer before their senior year in high school.
They started hanging out, then they started hanging out a little more, then they started hanging out alone. The next thing you knew, they were the hot item at Mansfield High. Up till then, Diane had always kept boys at arm's length, insisting that it was more important that she focus on her future. But something about her relationship with David changed it. Changed them both, actually. David started to become very protective, very controlling when he was around her. And Diane noticed her values began to change. She studied a little less. She stayed out a little more. And one of the tenets of her incredibly devout faith that she was certain she was going to save herself for marriage started to shake. Eventually, Diane and David started sleeping with each other. And in short order, really only a couple of months after they'd started dating these young high school kids, the two of them decided that someday they were going to marry. David, as I mentioned, had been in the Civil Air Patrol since he was a 12-year-old. He'd always known that one day he wanted to become a member of the Air Force. And so to that end, he'd applied to and been accepted to the Air Force Academy in Colorado. That's where he'd be going to college, no questions asked. For Diane's part, she wanted to join him, but she realized she was too late to apply there. So she came up with a plan. She'd apply to the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. They'd spend 4 years apart in different service academies through all of college, sure, and then be rough. But they had the certainty that only young lovers do, that they could get through any distance, any obstacle. And that when it all ended, Diane would transfer from the Navy to the Air Force, and then they'd once again be together. Again, they made these plans after having dated for only a couple of months. But to Diane and David, these plans rested on an unshakable foundation. Unshakable, that is, until late fall.
Diane and David's whirlwind of a relationship concerned their friends and family. David sold off some guns in order to purchase a small engagement ring for Diane. She enthusiastically accepted his proposal. Friends would later say that they preferred to be with the individual and not the couple. They seemed to change into completely different people when they were around each other. Once away from Diane, David's likable personality returned and his friends enjoyed his company. When he was around Diane, he was cold, distant, and consumed with her. Diane planned to save her virginity for her husband, but after falling so quickly in love with David, agreed to have sex with him. This act shook her faith, and she grew possessive and overly attached to him. When she was around her friends and family, she would obsessively talk about David. She once exclaimed, "If I can't be Mrs. David Graham, then I will die as Miss Diane Zamora." Diane's obsession greatly concerned her family, whose only consolation was that the pair agreed to set a wedding date for August 13, 2000. On November 4, 1995, David and Adrian were competing in a cross-country track meet in Lubbock, Texas. David offered to give Adrian a ride home once they made it back to Mansfield, which she accepted. David then claims that as they neared Adrian's home, she told him to take a detour and then instructed him to pull over at a local elementary school parking lot. David seemed to understand the cues given to him by Adrian. The pair had sex in his vehicle, and once complete, he dropped her off at home. Adrian never shared with anyone that she and David had sex that night. David, for his part, was more forthcoming about his encounter. He felt guilty for cheating on Diane and made up his mind to tell her everything that happened that night. Just not so quickly.
This didn't come up until December of their senior year. But when Diane heard this, reaction surprised, well, certainly David. She didn't get angry. She didn't break up with him on the spot, as lots of girls might have. Instead, in a way, hearkening back to her devout faith, she said they needed to repair their relationship, that the stain that Adrian Jones had imposed upon them had to be cleansed. Diane Zamora insisted that she and David Graham kill Adrian Jones. David, surprisingly, agreed. She convinced David to call up Adrian and have Adrian sneak out of her house late at night on a school night in early December.
On December 3rd, 1995, David called Adrian's home. Linda Sue answered the phone and told the young man that it was past curfew for Adrian, but she told Adrian that she would make an exception this one time. Once David had her on the phone, he said he wanted to hook up with her again. He asked her to sneak out of the house and meet him outside at 12:30 a.m. At first, Adrian was reluctant to do this, but David managed to convince her. When he arrived to pick her up, she got into the car and he drove to a secluded location on Sutton Road near Jewel Pool Lake. As David parked the car and leaned towards Adrian, Diane climbed out of the car's hatchback and into the back seat. David and Diane had a plan. They were going to break her neck and weigh her body down, hoping she would sink to the bottom of Jewel Pool Lake. Diane grabs her hair from behind and pulls down, which prompted Adrian to kick, scream, and scratch at Diane. David tried to intervene, but Adrian fought him off too. Adrian threw their plan off, and the pair realized it was, quote, either her or us. Diane grabbed a weight and struck Adrian several times on the back of the head. Adrian, disoriented from the blows, manages to escape the vehicle and run away. Diane screams at David she's getting away, and David pulls out a pistol he's carrying with him and runs after her. Adrian reaches a barbed wire fence, where she attempts to climb over it, causing tiny puncture wounds on her legs. Too overcome with shock, Adrian collapses in the field. David quickly approaches her and aims and shoots his pistol towards her head. He takes another shot to ensure she's not going to get up. They leave her now bloody body against the fence. David returns to Diane, and she tells him, "We shouldn't have done that," to which David replies, "Now you tell me." The murderous pair head to a friend's house, where they clean themselves up and borrow clothes. They pack the bloody clothes in garbage bags and discard them in a dumpster near Diane's house. They then drive to Diane's home, where Diane cleans out the car and David vomits after realizing fully what he had done. They decide to fall asleep and go on as if nothing happened. A man driving on Sutton Road on December 4th spots her lifeless body. He called police and said he thought he had seen a dead body near the fence lining. Police arrived to inspect the fence and found Adrian's battered body. At 6 o'clock that same morning, Adrian's alarm kept going off. Her mother walked into the room and turned it off. She was surprised to see Adrian's bed empty. At first, she thought Adrian had gone out for a jog, but when her ride to school came and went, she realized this was not the case. At 8 o'clock a.m., she places a phone call to the Mansfield Police Department and reports Adrian missing. When she arrives to the police station and provides a description of her daughter, she is asked to wait in another room. Detectives inform Bill and Linda Sue that they recovered a young woman's body near Jewel Pool Lake. Authorities request that they make an identification. With their world now obliterated and left heartbroken, they confirm that the young woman is their daughter, Adrian. Her family holds a service on December 7, 1995. A week later, the school held a service near the track. David chooses to attend.
In the days that followed, the town of Mansfield was shaken by the tragedy that had occurred. Police were able to discern that Adrian had escaped from the home that night on her own free will and volition, but they couldn't figure out where she had gone. Initially, the investigation centered on a teenager named Brian McMillan, who worked at a drugstore near the Subway sandwich shop where Adrian had worked earlier in her life. Brian McMillan was a depressive, medicated, and at one point had become infatuated with Adrian. So it was only natural that the police began their investigation there. It didn't lead to much, though. Brian had an alibi. He passed a lie detector test. And eventually, the police had to move on to other suspects. They ruled out the boy who was Adrian's nominal boyfriend. He had an alibi. And as the months ticked by and the case grew colder, it became clear that Adrian Jones' murder was not going to be readily solved. By the time spring rolled around, the school had decided to dedicate its yearbook to the memory of Adrian Jones, planted a tree in her honor, and Diane and David silently vowed to never tell anybody what they had done. It seemed they'd gotten away with their crime. And by summer 1997, David headed off for Colorado, Diane for Maryland, the two of them sure that their love had been strengthened, had been cemented, had been consecrated with the blood of this poor girl.
David and Diane seemingly lived double lives after the murder. Their obsession with each other intensified, and although they were many states apart, they wrote to each other every day via email. Diane would become so enraged if David did not respond to her emails within 24 hours. She revealed to her fellow cadets that she was worried David might be cheating on her. If her suspicions got the better of her, she would email David, telling him that an older student named Jay had kissed her. In response, David would remind her about what, quote, binds us together. While at the Naval Academy, Jay Guild, an older midshipman, asked Diane if David had ever cheated on her. Diane said yes and that she had asked David to kill the girl. Jay thought Diane was just being dramatic and didn't report it to any of the leadership. Diane enjoyed Jay's company and tried to pursue a relationship with him despite being engaged to David. She was conflicted over the emotions she was feeling for Jay, and he saw that. He told Diane that he was not interested in pursuing anything serious with her, and their flirtation fizzled out. Despite the promise of silence, Diane had let the cat out of the bag. Maybe she realized that no one would believe the story because of how ludicrous it sounded. For whatever reason, Diane could not keep quiet. Later, in August 1996, Diane told fellow officers Christina Mason and Jennifer McKerney that she and David had planned Adrian's death in response to the question, "What is the worst thing you have ever done?" They knew about Diane's codependent relationship with David Graham. It's all she ever talked about. But unlike Jay Guild, the girls believed Diane's confession. Jennifer McKerney told officers at the academy about what Diane had said. After searching for details to verify Diane's claims and realizing that Adrian's murder was still unsolved, those officers notified the police department. Shortly after the notification by the Naval Academy, detectives met with Diane on August 30th. She answered their line of questioning to an extent, but refused to acknowledge the confession she made to Jay and her two bunkmates. As a result, the Academy places Diane on a leave of absence. She immediately flew to Colorado to see David. There is no record of what took place between the two during her visit, but a photograph taken of the pair seems to reveal that they knew the jig was up and would likely never see each other again. She returns to Texas and prepares her story. The authorities speak with David on September 3, 1996. As expected, he denies all involvement and even offered to take a polygraph to prove his innocence. The following day, David sits for a polygraph, which reveals that he had done poorly in several areas. After hearing the results, David asked if he could speak with detectives in a more private area. They escort him to a separate interrogation room. There, David told them that he was the one who lured Adrian from her home that night, and that Diane had hidden in the back seat. Upon hearing this, police headed to Diane's to arrest her for the murder of Adrian Jones. Meanwhile, David refused to disclose what weapon they used to beat Adrian. Detectives, tired of playing the guessing game with him, showed him Diane's arrest warrant. Upon seeing the warrant, David suddenly said he was willing to provide a written statement detailing the murder of 16-year-old Adrian Jones. On September 6, Diane provided her confession. In it, she writes, "I remember that night. I think November 4th, 1995, and David showed up at my doorstep. He had just come back from Lubbock, and he had this look in his eyes that was horrible. He looked so scared. He had this red stuffed animal dog in his hands. I could tell something was wrong, but I figured he was just tired. A month later, I was coming into my house with him, and I was questioning him about past relationships, because he always told me that I was his first real girlfriend. I thought that was kind of strange, because most people have some kind of relationship of one kind or another. I remember he read off a list of names of girls he had known or gone places with that were kind of significant. I will never forget him mentioning the name Adrian, because that name kind of just stuck in my head. I guess I was asking a lot of questions. For some reason, I felt like I needed to ask about Adrian. He held back a lot, and we just went inside my house. When we got inside, we got into a big fight because, as always, he was trying to make me study for the SAT, and I didn't want to. We fought for a while, and at the end, when we stopped fighting and he had calmed down, he just looked at me and said, "I have something to tell. That is really important." I kind of knew what he was going to tell me, just by the way he looked at me. He told me, "You haven't been the only girl in my life," he said. "I have had sex with someone else before." I just looked at him in shock and I asked, did he mean he wasn't a virgin when he met me? And he said he was. I think that made me feel even worse because that means that he lost his virginity to me, but that he had been with someone else since. All I could do was question him and scream and blame myself for everything. I remember reaching out for this big brass thing, this brass rod, and aiming for him and trying to hit him because I was so upset. He took it away from me and tried to calm me down because I was screaming so hysterically. He was trying to protect himself from getting hurt, but he was also trying to protect me from hurting myself because I kept ramming my head against the walls, and when I was on the ground, I kept ramming my head into the floor, trying to crack my skull. I just didn't want to live with what he had said to me. I felt like I had lost everything. My hand wasn't working the way it should, and my family wasn't in the best financial state. And now he was telling me the one thing I prized more than anything else was taken away. I don't think I was thinking. In fact, I know I wasn't thinking. I screamed at him, "Kill her! Kill her!" He was just so scared that he wasn't about to say no to me. I was still banging my head against the floor. All David wanted to do was make everything better. It seemed like him agreeing to do that was the only thing that calmed me down. David promised that he would do that, and David never has broken a promise to me before. On December 2nd, 1995, we spent basically the weekend trying to get a hold of Adrian. I think we both expected to get caught really fast because we didn't spend much time thinking about what we were doing. The only time David planned anything was when he sat me down at his house for about 5 minutes to calm me down and throw stuff in his bag. The plan was for David to break her neck and sink her body to the bottom of Joe Pool Lake. About 12:30 a.m. on December 4th, 1995, we were at his house. David had said that he would meet Adrian at about 12:30 a.m., so we were late. We were driving my green Mazda Protege. It seemed like David put together what he was going to do really quick because he really didn't have much time to think. I had horrible pictures running through my head about what happened between him and Adrian, and they made me feel really, really sick. We met at her house at about 1:35 a.m. on December 4th, 1995. She thought she was coming out so they could have sex again. She came out to the car and got in. I was in the trunk and David was driving. I remember being real scared because at a time like that, when you kind of know what's happening, you really don't trust anyone. I remember wanting to turn back. I was afraid to move, so I just laid still in the trunk. David later told me that he felt the same way, that he wanted to turn back and take her home, but he was afraid of what I would do or say if he turned back. David usually always had a gun of some sort with him all the time. I knew that he had a 9mm with him. I also knew that he had the weights. I don't think we knew what we were really going to do. It was more like we were going to get out there and just do it. We picked up Adrian at her house, and we drove for about 15 to 20 minutes. There's a hatch in the back seat, and you can let it down, and it leads to the back seat from the trunk. David pulled over to the side of the road, and Adrian had already leaned her seat back, and he started, I guess, pretending that he was going to kiss her, and he motioned for me to pull the hatch down. I remember getting out and seeing that, and it made me all the more angry. I knew he didn't mean it, but it just made a bunch of pictures run in my head again. When she saw me, she kind of freaked out, and David held her down and said, "It's okay, we just want to talk to you." I think at that point, I could kind of tell he didn't want to do anything. I asked Adrian about she and David having sex, and she said she didn't enjoy it, that there was too much guilt. I guess it was the way she looked at me when she said it that made me so angry. I remember screaming at David all over again. All of it just became so real. I think I got kind of hysterical and I screamed, "Just do it, just do it." David just started wrestling with her basically, and she was trying to get away from him. I remember being scared that she was going to hurt him, and so I reached back where I knew the weights were on the ground to try and hit her with it. I missed. I was just so nervous, my hands were shaking too much. Probably the third time I did hit her on the head with the weight. I think the whole time the only thing going through my mind was what I was doing, but I knew that things had gone too far and I couldn't stop. Somehow, stopping seemed scarier than going on. David turned his back, I don't really remember why, and she slipped out of the window and ran off. We started to follow her with the car, but he didn't go far because she collapsed into a field on the side of the road. David jumped out of the car with his gun because he didn't want to leave someone there that could say something against us. He started running after her, but she collapsed before he got to her. He ran back to the car and he said, "She's dead." I was just too scared and I said, "Are you sure?" "No, she's not." I told him to shoot her. "She's not dead." He shot her twice in the head. I remember the first words out of his mouth were, "I love you, baby. Do you believe me now?" I said, "Yes, I believe you. I love you too." I don't think anything could compare to that fear and that horrible nauseous feeling that I had all week. I know God has forgiven us. I have spent a lot of time thinking after that. I would pray day and night that God would send me back so I could change what had happened. I would often start crying and tell David, "She didn't have to die." In a lot of ways, I wish I could have known her better. Everyone talked about how sweet she was, and that's something I will never know. My only comfort was that everything that happens, happens for a reason, and maybe that we didn't know what it was. But we hoped in time that we would find out, because I don't see how all that pain could have a reason. I've never read anything more cold-hearted and distant than Diane Zamora's confession. It literally made me sick to my stomach. But David's confession reminds me of a chapter in a highly dysfunctional romance novel. He wrote, "The month that followed was one of guilt and shame. I was always being told by Diane that our relationship was perfect and pure. The love we shared would never be broken. No one would ever come between us. No one, that is, except that one girl that had stolen from us our purity. I could never hold anything from Diane, nor she from me. She knew in my eyes that something was wrong the moment I decided to confess. When I did tell her, I thought the very life in her had been torn away. She was angry, she was violent, and she was broken. For at least an hour, she screamed sobs that I wouldn't have thought possible. It wasn't just jealousy. For Diane, she had been betrayed, deceived, and forgotten, all in that one meaningless instant in November. The purity which she held so dear had been tainted in that one unclean act. Diane had always held her virginity as one of her highest virtues. When we agreed to be married, she finally let her guard down long enough for our teenage hormones to kick in. When this precious relationship we had was damaged by my thoughtless actions, the only thing that could satisfy her womanly vengeance was the life of the one that had, for an instant, taken her place. The request of Adrian's life was, not for a second, taken lightly by me. I couldn't even believe she would ask that of me. Well, Diane's beautiful eyes have always played the strings of my heart, effortlessly. I couldn't imagine life without her. Not for a second did I want to lose her. I didn't have any harsh feelings for Adrian, but no one could stand between me and Diane. I was totally in love with her, and always will be. I regret it now, for never did I imagine the heartache it would cause my school, my friends, Adrian's family, or even my community. I guess I just shut it all out of my mind that instant when I convinced myself that Diane was even worth murder. After Diane gave me the ultimatum, I thought long and hard about how to carry out the crime. I was stupid, but I was in love. Signed, David Graham. Diane and David would have separate trials. The family of Adrian Jones requested that the death penalty not be sought in the trials. Unlike David and Diane, the Jones family cared about the impact that losing their children would have on the Graham and Zamora family.
The trials were short. Both Diane and David tried to point the finger of being the mastermind at the other. Their relationship finding it more and more difficult to bear the strain of the brunt of law enforcement and their guilt. What came out over the trial, though, over the course of the investigations, cast the most damning and difficult to understand truth upon the story of David Graham and Diane Zamora. David had told Diane that he had had sex with Adrian Jones after coming home from the regional track meet in November of their senior year. But it later came out that David Graham had actually left the track meet early, before Adrian Jones ever had, that he'd never given Adrian Jones a ride home, and in fact, almost definitely, never had sex with her at all. It seems that he told this to Diane Zamora simply to get a rise out of her, to test her feelings for him, to see just how strong their relationship was. When she responded so aggressively, so strongly, he was afraid to back down from his lie and was willing to ride it all the way to the end.
Diane and David are found guilty of capital murder in 1998. They are sentenced to life with the possibility of parole after 40 years. They attempted to maintain a relationship behind bars, but they eventually stopped corresponding with each other. Diane is currently housed in the Skyview unit in Rust, Texas. She married an inmate named Stephen Mora in 2003, but would later divorce him. She recanted her statement and claims to be innocent. She will be eligible for parole on September 5, 2036, when she will be 58 years old. David is serving out his sentence at the Allred unit in Iowa Park, Texas. He married in 2010, earned a bachelor's degree in criminology, and after initially recanting his statement, now says that his original confession is correct. David will be eligible for parole the same day as Diane. When speaking with Eric, I asked him his thoughts about the majority of the attention in the media being given to the narrative that Diane was a vengeful woman who managed to convince the pliable David with her womanly ways to commit a murder.
There's no question that both Diane and David are to blame, and indeed the courts agree, giving them both life sentences for murder. David, though not always painted as the jealous type quite like Diane was, certainly proved himself to be. Over the course of their physical separation between Colorado and Maryland, David sent Diane letters, threatening letters, in fact, demanding that Diane stay truthful, faithful, and comport herself with fealty towards him, saying that he was willing to do whatever it took to ensure that she was his and she remained his forever, which indeed is just as possessive and controlling as anything Diane might have been said to do with David. I think part of the issue of how Diane was painted relates back to the fact that unquestionably Diane was the mastermind of the murder. There's no contesting that driving in Diane's car and the fact of David being asked or pushed to go to these extremes was at Diane's behest. However, I agree that David should not get a free pass from any of them. David Graham is the one who pulled the trigger. Whatever Diane Zamora did or did not do, there is no question that ultimately David Graham is the one who took his pistol and fired a round into Adrian Jones's head, ultimately ending her life. So regardless of whether Diane did or did not push David to these levels, or to what extent she did, or even what she did to do so, David is the one who carried out this crime. And so ultimately, I, and indeed, the courts believe both David Graham and Diane Zamora are equally culpable for what they've done.
I asked him to elaborate on Diane's ever-changing confession, starting at the Naval Academy. I was left confused by her actions. She was such a dedicated student who was seen as very focused and determined, yet she made these critical errors when she made these two confessions. I wondered if it was a subconscious, guilty conscience.
I don't really think it was guilt. I think sometimes teenagers do dumb things. And among those dumb things usually is not murder. But often teenagers do run their mouths. It's just kind of part of growing up, is trying to impress your social group. And I think being in a new place where she didn't have friends, where she was desperately trying hard to fit in, far removed from the culture she'd grown up in and all her family and everyone she'd known, with her one critical piece of support made so by the crimes they'd committed, removed from her by thousands and thousands of miles, I think Diane simply found herself floundering to try to wait to gain a position of respect, power, and equity and acceptance within her new community by flaunting to all of these people simply that, so that she could gain a position within her new social group.
In 2016, Diane proclaimed her innocence to the TV show Dateline. Eric gives his thoughts on a possible motive behind the odd interviews.
Now, again, it only stands to reason that over the course of time, people's recollections would change, but I don't think that's what's happening here. I think as Diane gets farther and farther from the crime she committed as a teenager, and she gets farther and farther removed from the feelings of love for the boyfriend that she once had, but instead is thinking about the looming possibility of parole. She is up for parole, not soon, but in 2036, which might present to Diane the first opportunity over the course of 40 years in prison to be a free person again. I think Diane is trying to distance herself as far as possible from the crimes and the acts that she took part in and participated in, so that she might lead, at least in her 60s, some semblance of a quote-unquote normal life, despite the guilt that she bears.
I asked Eric what led him to include this story in his new book, Double Lives, True Tales of the Criminal Next Door.
You know, there are a number of reasons why the story of David Graham, Diane Zamora, and Adrian Jones really stuck with me. Part of it, of course, part of what led me to it, I should say, was that it really fit the bill of the types of crimes that had interested me. These are two people absolutely living a double life, absolutely perpetrating these horrible crimes in their hometowns while presenting placid faces to all those around them. But really, there was more to it than that. These students were in high school when I was in high school. They're the same age as me. And I've seen photos of David Graham and Diane Zamora when they were in high school, when they were together in the fall of their senior year. And they look a lot like the kids I was in high school with. I could see those kids as being kids I grew up with. And so thinking about researching this book and starting on this project, because I was inspired by what had happened to some of the kids I knew as a youth, it made me think that I really, really needed to work to include the best and most comprehensive story I could about these two, or really these three young people, and what happened to them late fall, early winter day in 1996.
Eric would like to leave the audience with some final thoughts.
You know, one thing that was really interesting to me as I was researching Double Lives, Two Tales of the Criminals Next Door, is that more of my friends from high school died as I was researching and writing this book. A number of them, actually. And it was for a reason very different from the reasons that other people had died earlier. And it had to do with opioids. Over the course of me writing and researching this book, two more students that I went to high school with, two more of the 60 boys from my grade, died from opioid overdoses. And more in America, that's unfortunately becoming the new normal. We are all starting to find that people we know are leading secret double lives that aren't necessarily criminal, aren't necessarily painful or harmful to anyone other than themselves. And having talked to sheriffs and law enforcement officers all across the country while researching this book, I've heard time and again that the new single biggest threat, the new single biggest double life that people are leading is addiction to opioids and the opioid epidemic that is spreading across the country. That has really impacted me and how I feel, and I urge all the listeners to True Crime fan club, as you're hearing these stories and as you're thinking about people leaving double lives, please take a look at some of the people in their own life. And if anyone is being affected by this horrible epidemic, to please say something, reach out to them, reach out to treatment centers, and really do all you can to help these people who are also hiding these horrible, horrible secrets.
Eric has graciously offered to provide an autographed copy of his new book, Double Lives, True Tales of the Criminal Next Door, to one lucky listener of True Crime Fan Club. In order to be entered into the contest, you must first follow Eric on Instagram or like him on Facebook. Links will be in the show notes. Once you've done that, send a screenshot of your like or follow to me at tcfcpod@gmail.com, along with your shipping address. The contest ends on August 30th, with the winner being announced on August 31st. If you can't wait that long, you can purchase Eric's book on Amazon or wherever books are sold. I'll give you a link in the show notes. On August 14th, Eric will be hosting an AMA on Reddit, so please feel free to join him.
I can be found on Facebook by searching for my name, Eric Brock. That's Brock like Brock's candy corn, B-R-A-C-H. As for my Instagram, which I love, it's Barack Obama, not because of any political persuasion one way or the other, just because it happens to be a pretty good pun. That's B-R-A-C-H-O-B-A-M-A. I tweet very rarely, but now and again at ebrockwrites.
I would like to extend my deepest thanks to Eric for coming onto the show and joining me on this immersive storytelling journey. This is a case I've always been interested in, but never knew when I would cover it. You are immensely talented, my friend, and I thank you so much for your writing and your advocacy for those fighting opioid addiction. I have personally lost somebody to that, and it's devastating. So if you know someone who needs help, please contact the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. Or 4357. SAMHSA's National Helpline is a free, confidential, 24/7, 365-day-a-year treatment referral and information service in English and Spanish for individuals and families facing mental and/or substance abuse disorders. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. Music for the show is composed by Nico at We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Audio engineering is provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music. Content warning at the top of the episode is provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. Research assistance provided by Brittany Martinez and Haley Gray.